Hello, welcome to another edition of Backstage. It's Anzac Day here in Australia, which is obviously a special time for all Aussies and New Zealanders because it gives us a chance to reflect and pay tribute to servicemen and women past and present. For this episode, I wanted to talk about the Battle of Kokoda. It's quite personal to myself because my grandfather fought in Kokoda in 1942, and he was in the 39th Battalion. They were the militia, and they're the first battalion to meet the Japanese, and they were outnumbered 10 to 1, and they're relatively untrained. They didn't have a lot of training compared to the guys in the AIF, but I thought I'd bring on someone that is super passionate about the story of Kokoda and knows a lot of detail about the battle back to front, and that is David Howe. He served as an infantry soldier in the Army Reserve as a co-founder of Kokoda Historical. He's literally taken thousands of people on the Kokoda track, and he shared many amazing and deeply moving experiences along the way. David's also the current secretary of the 39th Battalion Association. Thanks for joining us, mate. It's obviously a different Anzac Day today. It's the first time since 1919 they haven't been able to do the full dawn service. Is a bit of a strange sort of feeling around Anzac Day today?
Yeah, it certainly is different. I would say from a personal point of view, and I do say that I wouldn't want it to be this way, but now that it is this way, I enjoyed a really nice Anzac Day dawn service at the front of my house. I set up a little bit of a display and lit a candle, and in the end we had about 10 neighbours in their houses in my vicinity that came out, and I played the ABC through the phone with the last post, and there was a bit of a pause, and I recited the ode, and I think people appreciated that. Although we couldn't see each other, I had my daughter, she had my medals on. It's the first time I've ever been in Australia with my kids on Anzac Day, so I made the best of a worse situation.
Now, as I said at the top of the show, you're super passionate about military history and history in general, but what is it about Kokoda and the campaign that drew you towards it?
I think the two key elements is, first of all, the story. So it's a classic story of, the underdog triumphing over the superior. And what I mean by that is that you have to understand that where the Kokoda campaign took place was on Australian territory. It was in an area known as Papua at the time, and Papua was sovereign territory of Australia. And the men that went to face the Japanese to begin with were only able to serve within Australian territory. And obviously, unlucky for them, Papua was Australian territory at the time. So you had either very old guys who had served in the First World War in the interwar years in the militia, we had young guys who were doing their compulsory universal training that, couldn't go outside of Australian territory, but ended up in Papua and ended up against an enemy who, on the other hand, was well-trained, well-disciplined, had certainly seen combat long before they got to fight Australian militiamen at Kokoda. So that's one element of it. And the second element is that this is so close to home. I mean, the furthest northern point to the furthest southern point of PNG is only 160 km. It was war on our doorstep, and it's still within living memory. So if you combine those two things together, you end up having a situation where, it makes for all the hallmarks of an epic struggle between, an underdog and a superior foe.
Now, I was talking before about the 39th Battalion, given the connection with my grandfather. Now, I don't know everything about the 39th, but from what I gathered, it was a group of guys that came together with very little training, and they were sort of told, I think they had 6 or 7 weeks of training, and they were told, listen, you're heading off to Papua, but pack your tennis rackets. You won't be doing any fighting. We need you to sort of set up the airport. And they've all gone, and these, as you said, were young guys and a lot of farmers and these sort of knockabout blokes. And they get there and then they say, oh, shit, hang on, the Japanese are here. We need you to go up to the front line. And they had sort of World War One weapons and they were outnumbered 10 to 1. How accurate is that sort of synopsis for what happened with the 39th in particular?
Yeah, I'd say it's I'd say it's half accurate, and I say half because I don't want to undermine the credit that those infantry soldiers had. So on one hand, you had a lot of young guys who had to do, and let's make no mistake about it, if you were 18 to 35, unmarried, not in a protected trade, and had no physical impediment, you had to do militia service. As I said before, militia service, unlike AIF, Australian Imperial Force, you could not be sent out beyond Australian territory. So you had a lot of younger guys who were commanded by older guys, many of which had seen service in the First World War. But, you know, the terms of their training. Now, I'm very quick to dismiss the idea that they were, they certainly were ill-equipped with weapon systems, but under-trained, well, no. They spent time at Darley, which is near Bacchus Marsh in Melbourne. They'd done training, and I think in terms of their brigade, there's three battalions to a brigade. 39th was one of those battalions of the 30th Brigade, that they had fairly good training. However, the training they were receiving was not for the theatre that they were going into, which is jungle warfare. In fact, prior to 1942, the only experience that Australian soldiers had really had with jungle warfare was in the First World War, and it was very, very slim. It was right at the start, before Gallipoli, in September of 1914, when they got the call to go to Rabaul in East New Britain, an island above PNG, to take out the German wireless station. So very, very little had been done on jungle warfare. The 39th were trained, like most soldiers, for a theatre which represented the desert, where Australia was fighting in North Africa and then later in Syria, but very, very different than the jungles. So I think they received training, but they weren't trained for the theatre of jungle warfare. Now, and the other thing I would say, yes, you're correct in saying that they had First World War weapon systems. I mean, B Company of the 39th that first faced the Japanese in conjunction with the Papuan Infantry Battalion were armed with Lewis guns, which was a First World War light support weapon. So, yeah, by comparison to their counterparts, they certainly were ill-equipped, and not to mention the colour of their uniforms, and they were ill-trained for the theatre that they were going to fight in.
How would have they gone, from an outsider's perspective? It obviously looks like it requires a lot of discipline and the process of following a plan and being quite structured. How would have these guys gone without that sort of length of time to get those systems down pat? Did they really think that they were going to be that successful when they first sent them off to fight the Japanese?
So Australia's reaction to just prior to the war in the Pacific, they knew that there was likelihood of Japanese aggression in the region. And in fact, they sent an AIF division, the 8th Division, forward to the north. Obviously, the 8th Division was famously lost at the fall of Singapore, but there were three particular subunits, if you will, within that division, which made up, named after birds, literally named after birds that were sent to our north, which was Ambon, Timor and Rabaul in Sparrow, Gull and Lark Force. And the latter there, Lark Force, was sent to Rabaul, which was outside of Australian territory in the sense of sovereign territory. It was inside Australian mandated territory. They went there to garrison it. So Australia thought that they would have some sort of response to send to the buffer zone to our immediate north. And in terms of the militiamen, and again, I reiterate that they could only be sent within Australian territory, they were sent to Australian soil, which is Papua, to garrison it. And very early on in the Pacific War, you think Japan came into the war officially when it made aggression against the Philippines, controlled by the Americans, but more famously, I guess, is the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the attack on Pearl Harbor, which brought Japan into the Second World War. So Australia was really caught with their pants down and only made a token effort, because most of our fighting force, if you will, the AIF, was already committed to the war against the Italians and the Germans in North Africa. So really Australia was caught on the back foot in terms of preparedness and being able to counter the Japanese advance.
What were the fighting conditions like? I remember as a kid, you know, talking to granddad, and you know, I'd say, oh, you know, what was the war like? And all he'd say is he had the same shoes and socks on, and after 2 weeks, he'd take his socks off, and half his foot would go with it. It sounded like there was pretty horrific conditions. Yeah,
I think that I think that it's important to remember is the time. So obviously, we're talking. You know, well, it's 75 years this year since the war has ended. So, you know, we're talking a different time frame in terms of technology. So, in terms of their uniforms and their equipment, and as I said before, we'd not been conditioned to or trained for jungle warfare. And the conditions in the jungle, first of all, you take out the fact that the Owen Stanley Range for the Kokoda campaign we fought. You know, it's only the highest point, Mount Bellamy, is only 40 metres shy of the highest point in Australia, Mount Kosciuszko. So you have this, if you will, this issue of the mountains, but you couple that with the fact that it's jungle. I mean, the Owen Stanleys get on average around 5 metres of rainfall a year. So, you know, you imagine hundreds, if not thousands of boots marching across a single narrow jungle track, which was originally a series of tracks for a mail route which linked up Port Moresby to the village of Kokoda. Kokoda was important because it had an airfield. So, you know, you've got this big mountain range and you've got a track crossing the spine of it, if you will, which goes up and down through rivers, through swampy areas, through, you know, this temperate sort of rainforest and all these different conditions which are much different than what any of the Australian soldiers are trained in. And then you combine that with one of the most deadliest killers in the world, which is malaria. And you have mosquitoes and you have things like dengue fever. You have all of these tropical conditions, not to mention the fact you can imagine what leather boots and khaki drill uniforms do with chafing and rubbing skin raw. And then you combine that with warfare, malnourishment, all of those elements that play together, which conspire, if you will, for both sides, I must say, not just for the Australians, but also for the Japanese. They conspire to make a difficult situation even more difficult, if that makes sense.
You've obviously done the trek many a times now. Is it still an eerie feeling when you're walking in the same turf where these battles took place?
Yeah, the one thing about Kokoda, unlike other battlefield pilgrimages, and I do say pilgrimages because it is a thing for Australians with the idea of Anzac to go and visit battlefields on far distant lands. The difference is, and I've led many a battlefield tour to Gallipoli, Western Front, those sort of places, is that you have to pay a penance in order to be able to do your battlefield pilgrimage because you're going without the comforts of home. You're for, you know, at least 8 or 9 days in the jungle. And, you know, when you are walking for that period of time, every step you take, you are walking on hallowed ground. It's not like you go and visit a battlefield, get into the bus and go back to the comforts of the pub or a hotel. You're sleeping, eating, walking, going to the toilet, doing all of those daily activities on an Australian battlefield. And I can tell you now, after 60-odd crossings of the Kokoda Track, you know, the thing that haunts me the most is just on the half-life, either in the morning or the afternoon, and you are on a battlefield and you look out into the jungle where you can't really see more than a few metres in front of you, and to think these are the conditions that our soldiers face, where the enemy could be just around the next corner and you wouldn't even know it. They could be almost like these peering eyes looking at you, and you can still feel and have that sensation today when you take that pilgrimage.
They often talked about how important the fuzzy wuzzies were in the Battle of Kokoda. How crucial were they to victory for the Australian and Allied forces?
Well, what I'd say about the fuzzy wuzzy angels, and first of all, the fuzzy wuzzy angels is a nice feel good term, because let's make no mistake about it, they were indentured labour. Their primary purpose was not to carry wounded Australians out, rather they were there to carry in the supplies of war. So things like, you know, weapon systems, ammunitions, food, all of those things that you need in order to wage war. So those things was their primary purpose. And where they came from, you know, like the Owen Stanley, where the Owen Stanley mountain range, where the Kokoda Track is made up of two main cultural groups, the Koyaris, which is on the southern end, and the Orokivas on the northern end. Now, the people who worked up there, the Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels that worked on the Kokoda track, they were, if you were a plantation owner or you were in industry and you were a European or an Australian, let's not beat around the bush, an Australian that were up there, you were ordered by martial law to register how many staff you had. And you had to justify what your proportion of labor force was, and you had to bring those men, if you will, forward in order to be able to have them work. So many of those men, Fuzzy Wuzzy Angel, lived along the coast, for example. And when they went up into the Owen Stanleys, it was very cold, it was very wet, often with very poor conditions. And there was men like Doc Vernon, a First World War veteran that was attached to the Australian New Guinea Administration Unit, who was helping set up with Bert Kienzel to look after the conditions and to ensure that the supply line went through. It was not nice for them. But in terms of what it meant for the Australian soldier, it was imperative that we had men to be able to, yes, carry the supplies in, but I guess to immortalise it, to carry the wounded out. And many Australian, as the poem Fuzzy Wuzzy Angel said, many a mother owes the life of their son to the fact that the Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels brought them back safely. So we should never undermine or forget their contribution to the campaign.
Were you able to talk to any Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels that were there during the battle that was still around when you started doing the tours?
Yeah, I met a few over the years, but you imagine the life expectancy in PNG next to the life expectancy of a veteran in Australia. You know, in PNG, they don't have the same life expectancy as what we do here. But I did have the good fortune in 2017, in the 75th anniversary, to be involved with bringing out Havala Lala, who was one of the last and few surviving original carriers from the campaign to Australia. He's unfortunately passed away now. But And he didn't speak English, and to be able to hear him, and very little pidgin English, but spoke his Koyari language. But to be in the presence of somebody who had been one of the lucky few to survive that long, but to recall, you know, carrying drums of ammunition and bags of rice and gathering it up from Lake Myola, where the biscuit bombers are dumped food and stuff from. I mean, it was awe-inspiring after spending so much time with veterans, but to hear it straight from the horse's mouth, if you will, of a real-life Fuzzy Wuzzy Angel. And that is probably one of the most memorable times I've had being involved in this subject.
Yeah, that's fantastic. We didn't talk to Grandad much about his experiences in the wild. I think there's maybe a handful of people that he actually would get together with, old veterans that he fought alongside, and they could talk about what they'd experienced. But when he passed away, we found a box of memorabilia type stuff where there was photos of Japanese families, and there was some Japanese money with blood on it and things like that, lots of old letters that we didn't even know it existed. Was it pretty common for guys that fought in that war to probably keep a lot of the things that they saw and experienced to themselves? And did you talk to many of the guys from the 39th, and were they willing to share a lot of the experiences that they went through?
Well, you know, the funny thing is I was very lucky to meet a lot of the veterans towards the end of their lives, and many, unfortunately, that I did meet have long since left us. In fact, there's only a handful that remain, and I am in awe in the fact that I speak to their next of kin, you know, the sons or the grandsons or daughters, if you will, who say, oh, granddad or father never spoke of the war. And I think towards the very end of their lives, they opened up a little bit. And I was fortunate to be there in that time. My own grandfather, he didn't fight on the Kokoda track, but he did fight in New Guinea. He didn't really tell me much about the fighting side and the lighter side of army life. And I was too young. I was 16 when he died. But I was in the good fortune to be in Sydney and in Melbourne and get to speak to many members of the 55th, 53rd Battalion and the 39th Battalion. And they certainly opened up towards the end of their years. And it was quite humbling to be in their presence and to think that, you know, they opened up to a complete stranger and not to their family. And I think that is testament to that generation, that they came home, they just thought that they'd get on with it, and they didn't burden their family with the fact that they had you know, all of this terrible things that they saw in war, and it was only in the later years that they decided to you know, bring about their stories and to tell people. And again, you know, very humbling to be in the presence of men when they decided to do that.
The 39th were also known as the referred to as Choco soldiers, and it seemed like they didn't have much respect pre battle, but then that probably would have changed, you know, after the conclusion of the war. Is that what the situation was for those guys?
Without a doubt. As I said earlier, militiamen couldn't go outside of Australian territory. They were designated in their service number not to have an X in it. So, for example, if you were from Victoria, you would have a V number. So you'd have V and then 1234 or whatever the number may be after it. If you're AIF, you would have VX 1234, and the X meant that you were AIF. So that the AIF, again, sent overseas, militiamen couldn't be. So Australia had a two-army system. And in fact, we still almost to this day between reserves, and I was a reservist called a Choco, you know, chocolate soldiers melt in the heat of battle. But there was certainly that issue that existed prior to 1942 between the men that were in the Middle East and people who were only able to serve overseas in Australian territory. But the difference is that when you hit Kokoda, you know, you know, the 39th Battalion were, other than the PIB, were the first to meet and hold the Japanese, who weren't militia soldiers. They were the number one soldiers, if you will, coming on the offensive to take Port Moresby by way of overland track over Kokoda. And they get to meet the 39th, and the 39th have them at two battles. First battle at Kokoda, 29 July 42, and the second battle between the 8th and 10th of August 42. They stay and they hold the Japanese. Obviously, they can't hold them indefinitely, but they fall back to a place called Isarava, and that's where the wonderful memorial is today with the four pillars: courage, endurance, sacrifice, and mateship. But here they are, you know, dug in, waiting for two things to happen, either for the Japanese to overrun them or for the AIF to arrive. And that's exactly what happened. Members of the 21st Brigade under the commander Brigadier Potts made it, got in the same trench with the 39th, and had the Battle of Isarava, where Bruce Kingsley won the VC. And that was the first time in history that that the Australian militiamen and AIF had fought together. So the Chocos and the AIF fought together on the battlefield, and after that, things start to change. The AIF had the respect of the militia because they were there. In fact, some of them, including the 39th, they were there to be able to stay and fight against the Japanese without, you know, without on their own. They went back with the AIF in order to be able to fight the Japanese. And without that, undoubtedly, the battle wouldn't have gone. I mean, it didn't go in our favour, but it would have happened quite quickly, and it wouldn't have slowed the Japanese advance across Kokoda.
I remember another story as well that was it sort of halfway through the campaign that one of the big generals came in and gave him a bit of a rev up. I don't think my grandfather took criticism that well, and I think he was asking more of the 39th. Was there a story around that? Because I know he definitely got the shits up, whatever this general or whatever had to say.
Yeah, so I think the story is really the rabbit that runs speech, which happened at a place called Koitake, which was showgrounds at the southern end of the Kokoda track. That was at the end of the furthest part of the Japanese advance. So after the Battle of Brigade Hill, the 21st Brigade was lined up on the showground. The 21st Brigade were the 2nd 14th, 2nd 27th. And the 2nd 16th. It was really aimed at them. It wasn't so aimed at the militia, because the militia were, of course, in a sense, regarded by Sir Thomas Blamey, who was the Commander-in-Chief of Land Forces of the Southwest Pacific. It was more aimed at the AIF, but the stigma still attached. And you know, I think the speech goes something along the lines of, it's not the man with the gun that gets shot, it's the rabbit that runs. And that was aimed at the fact that the Australian soldiers had been pushed so far back across the Kokoda track that you know, the high command thought, well, hang on a second, we're losing we're actually losing the battle here. Why are these Japanese pushing us back so far? So, that's where it came from. But the stigma attached itself to all of those, especially men like the 39th that were involved in the early stages of the Kokoda campaign. And it's, I guess it was unfair. And it certainly was, although interpreted not to be such. But nonetheless, it certainly rubbed off the wrong way, and a lot of the veterans and the stigmas attached is still there, still echoes to this day.
Obviously, Anzac Day is important to reflect on stories like we're sharing today. But how important is it, particularly for the younger generation, to know about what happened at Kokoda and so forth? Because obviously, the main one we hear about is obviously Gallipoli and so forth. But how important is the Kokoda story, do you think?
Well, in the words of Paul Keating, who went to... in 1992, I think it was, went there, and he said words to the effect of, it wasn't for the old world that they were fighting for, it was for the new. And I think that's right, in the sense that, you know, the old idea of imperialism, of the fact that we were British, that we went to the other side of the world to defend Britain, a new order was taking place, and Australia was fighting on Australian territory in Papua. As I said before, Australian territory was Papua. They were fighting for our ideals, for our way of life, and for our very existence. I mean, it's all right to have a revisionist history which claims that Japan was never going to invade Australia, and that may be so, but if you imagine, in the hearts of the men that were there in 1942, they really believed that Japan was coming to ride trams in St Kilda, if you will. And why not? They were on our doorstep, and they needed to be stopped. And those men that went up there, militiamen who otherwise would not have fought overseas against a determined enemy, were doing that very thing. And I think we should never, ever lose sight of that.
Obviously, I appreciate you coming on Anzac Day. It's obviously a big time for people like yourself to gather around, you know, and share stories and experiences and so forth. But is there any stories from the 39th that jump out that you can think of from the guys that you spoke to?
There is one story which I always tell in order to convey the message of the 39th Battalion. Is the story of Jim Cowie, MC. Jim Cowie was a member of the same company as Albert Jacka. He was a second day lander. He landed at Gallipoli on the 26th of April 1915, so in the 14th Battalion, which was very, very famous battalion, because obviously Albert Jacka had won the first VC for Australia in the First World War. But Jim Cowie, who was a man who had been an enlisted man at the time of the first the Gallipoli landings, had gone on to be commissioned and was part of the AIF expansion and moved into the sister battalion. That's where they took half of the guys in the 14th and they put them away, and other units, they put them into a new unit. And he went off onto the Western Front, got a military cross, came back, was a bit disenchanted when the appeasement of Nazi Germany on the very outset, just before the Second World War, and had actually resigned his reserve commission, had sent his medals, his military cross, back into Victoria Barracks, said, I don't want anything to do with this. Then war is on our doorstep with Japan, and it unfolds that he volunteers for service. He's pretty old. He's 56, I think, at the time. And he is put into the militia as one of those old and bold. He's one of the few that survived the cull going up for tropical service. And history just places him as a guy that served in Gallipoli at Kokoda, at the Second Battle of Kokoda. He's with A Company. He's a staff sergeant. And in the heat of battle, when the orders had been given to withdraw, Jim Cowie. Now, this is a guy who at Gallipoli had shrapnel wound above his right eye and was evacuated twice, three times. He would have been back to Gallipoli, but he didn't get back because the campaign was over. And he makes it up to Kokoda at 56 years of age. And he, in the dark of the night, when the fog is coming down over the rubber plantation, A Company, which was a company of the 39th that was tasked with the Second Battle of Kokoda, as a mainstay, I should say, there's other companies involved. and he was, and the men are starting to make their way back to Zuniga. There's chaos around, and Jim Cowie takes it upon himself to pick up men. Men like Jim Cowie, who got a military medal at Kokoda and would later go on to serve in Vietnam. But, you know, he said of Jim Cowie, the coolest, bravest soldier I'd ever met. He's a guy, Jim Cowie, who went through and he said to the men, he said, don't run. He said, the Japanese don't know who we are in the dark. He said, let's just calmly walk out. And on his way back through the back of the airfield, a Juki, a machine gun, a woodpecker machine gun, opens up on the men. JD and the other chaps, they sort of scatter. And Jim Cowie, wounded above the right eye, picks up a rifle, takes a side picture with his right-handed, but he takes a side picture with his left eye. He kills the number one on the machine gun. The number two comes on. He takes him out, and he says, boys, we shouldn't go this way. Let's go the other way. And he ends up staying up all night and getting the men back. He should have been at least given a gong for that. But, of course, he resigned his commission, sent his MC into Victoria Barracks. And he wasn't to get it. But it's men like that. Imagine that, Gallipoli to Kokoda. They're the guys who are really the essence of the whole story of Kokoda.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. I hadn't heard that story before. It's yeah, it's remarkable the bravery in times of extreme stress, how they can stay level headed. But obviously, you know, there's such a strong mateship amongst all those guys that went through such horrific conditions and the situation where they simply outnumbered and outgunned, but they came over the top in the end. It's unbelievable. Obviously with the trekking side of things, I got to meet people at an orientation event, and it was from all walks of life, all different fitness levels. Pretty much you get a licorice all sort bunch that come on the treks to experience Kokoda, yeah?
Yeah, so Kokoda these days is sort of a rite of passage, if you will, for Australians. And yes, you're right, you get an all sort. You get a licorice all sort, if you will. People of all different fitness levels, all different occupations, etc. And some are prepared more than others. But the common bond, if you will, is that I guess for Australians, it is that pilgrimage that I said before. And you have to take a penance. You have to undertake a certain amount of penance in order to achieve it. You deprive yourself of the luxuries of normal life. And by doing that, I think people feel, I certainly do, you feel a greater connection to the idea of Anzac. You go without, obviously you can never recreate what happened during war, but by putting yourself through that, you imagine if you'd not done much physical exercise, you'd never been camping before, which happens to me a lot, and you go up there and you put yourself through those hardships because you are getting yourself closer to that idea of what Anzac's all about. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. I think, I think the more you train, the better level of comfort or rather, level of ability that you'll have to do it, and you'll find it a bit easier. But at the end of the day, regardless of where you come from, I think you are putting yourself out. And you are getting closer to the Anzac story, and Kokoda is a perfect proving ground for that and the perfect way to undertake a modern day idea of penance to get closer to remembrance. And is that a bad thing? I don't think so. I think it's a good thing.
No, I totally agree, mate. As I said, like we're definitely looking forward to coming on the trek in July. With the current situation, it looks like that'll probably be delayed, but we're definitely going to get over and I'm going to document the journey as well. What I thought I might finish the chat on is, by pure coincidence, my father was sent a poem written by someone in the 39th, and they wrote this poem whilst they were in Guinea. It's from Dawn Wilkinson, and her father wrote it. And I want to leave you with this one. And it's called The Unwrapped Chocolate Soldier. It says, you saw him in your town or strolling down the street. You saw him in his uniform that always looked so neat. You heard him in the dance hall with your hands upon his shoulder, cursing fate and his bad luck, the unwrapped chocolate soldier. You labelled him a choco because he didn't fight. You thought he didn't have the guts to stick up for his rights. You heard him in the bar, and if you felt a little bolder, you didn't hesitate to say another choco soldier. But now your tone is different when the war is at our door. You rarely hear the saying choco soldier anymore. By God, you'll thank your maker before you are much older for the man who kept the Japs away, the unwrapped chocolate soldier. You don't know how he cursed the flies and swore at dust and heat. He has put away his uniform that always looks so neat. He wears a ragged pair of shorts and shirt when he is colder. He's putting up with pests and flies, the unwrapped chocolate soldier. He's living in a leaky tent, his rations often short, but he thinks of all the steak and eggs, the food that once he bought. But when the Zers fill the sky, his rage begins to smolder. When he sees his cobbers fall and die, the unwrapped chocolate soldier. His AA guns and small arms too were shields of your defence. His body first to take the blow. And if you're not too dense to know, you'll take your hat off to the man before you are much older. The man you used to spurn and name, he's only a Choco soldier.
Yeah, wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah, so I'll have to send you a copy of that. But yeah,
my friend, I have to run. My lift is here, but it's a wonderful chat.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate you coming on and having a chat, mate, because for a lot of listeners, there's probably a lot of people in places like Europe that don't know anything about the Kokoda campaign. And obviously from an Australian and New Zealand perspective, it's something really special. And, yeah, really appreciate all that you do, mate, to keep the stories alive and spread the word about what's happening and give people that experience. So, no, really, really appreciate it, mate.
No worries.
Look forward to catching up soon. And if people do want to join you on the trek, where do they go, mate?
Just go to www.kokodahistorical.com.au. I have a page dedicated to Anzac Day on Kokoda for 2021.
All right, mate. I really appreciate it. And yeah, no doubt be in touch and we'll speak to you soon.
Thanks, mate. All the best.
Enjoy, mate. Too easy.
Cheers, mate. Bye-bye.
See ya.